Sleigh Closet or read the book that he wrote about it or whatever? I mean,
that was actually the first time I heard of him.
Yeah.
But they did show Larry Kramer in the documentary too.
Yeah. They were friends, I think. Yeah. You know, but it was like kind of a small knit group, even though it was trans across the continent. You know, I mean, there's a lot of.
And they talked about the ACT UP.
Yeah.
The team left the Gay Alliance.
Yeah.
And then he moved to ACT UP.
He was actually an important person. If you don't know what we're talking about here, is Vito Russo. He's a famous gay scholar, gay cinema scholar, really. Have any of you ever heard of the documentary, The Celluloid Closet? Which is about sort of the history of like gay people on film and stuff like that. Anyway, he wrote a book about it, and they made it into a documentary. But he was sort of like an archivist of film and media images related towards just gay culture, you know, and he had been doing this since the 60s and 70s, and then, of course, HIV and AIDS came along, so he became sort of a key sort of archivist, sort of recorder for that, too. And because, as we've talked about in class, and as we're going to see later, when some of the South African activist stuff we're doing, AIDS activism was so visually sort of inspired and thrust, you know, Vito Russo became almost like a valuable consultant, if you will, towards like what AIDS activism had to look like and what it had to work with, so to speak, given all that background. But anyway, what we're talking about is this documentary, I guess, on HBO. So I didn't even know, so I'm going to have to go check that out.
I'm going to say, if anybody's interested in the class, that the documentary really does play like an order of what we've learned so far from like the gay liberation, the first diagnosis through the clinical trial. I think one of the lines that he said was, you can go to Europe and they approve drugs in 9 months, and why can't we do it in the U.S.? It takes 5 to 10 years. So it definitely touches on each.
How long is the documentary? Is it one part or is it a multi-part?
It's one part.
Yeah.
I believe it's only 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's from HBO, too, it's probably a pretty decent quality then, too, since they actually fund quite significantly the documentaries they do. Anyway, check it out if anybody wants to. It sounds like I'm going to after class. It sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. So today we're talking about international AIDS policy and also sort of like connections internationally. What we're going to do actually today is sort of a kind of three little short things. I want to start by talking about a couple of the articles. What I want to do is see if we can put on the board a kind of like cheat sheet of some kind, or what are the major issues that we're talking about that become complicated ethically when we're talking about AIDS care and AIDS treatment and AIDS prevention internationally and globally, sometimes depending on the location, and sometimes that migrate across nationalities, geographies, races, ethnicities, times, so to speak. So we'll try to think about what those issues are. We'll do that by sort of garnering or glossing through some of these articles. Then I'm going to have us turn and look a little bit at a couple of examples that we have here, both from South Africa, talking about some examples of healthcare activism that are happening internationally. The last thing that we're going to do today is we're going to use this booklet that I made some pages for you. This thing called Every 17 Seconds, which provides vignettes of about, I think, how many did I give you? Like 7 or 8 different countries or something like that? What we're going to do is sort of break into groups, and each group is going to take one of the vignettes. What I'd like us to do then is take about 20 minutes or so in our individual groups looking at the pages that were provided for today so that we can come back and share 4 different sort of vignettes of what AIDS looks like and has looked like internationally. And what you're going to do during that 20 minutes is, of course, just gloss over the pages in your section, but also I'm going to have you go to 2 websites, Aid for AIDS, which is one of the largest international AIDS charitable organizations, and UNAIDS, which is the United Nations AIDS website. And this book, Every 17 Seconds, actually came out about, I want to say like 95, 98, something like that. I want you to provide for us, the group, sort of where is the status of AIDS activism and AIDS sort of care in that country that you're focusing on today. Very easy to find online. But the point being, I think, we're just going to kind of put in the air today, because we've been talking all semester about sort of like across times and across different geographies, the way in which AIDS has complicated our ethical responsibilities to patients. Thus, I want to end today's class by just saying, let's take a moment and look at 4 snapshots, if you will, so to speak. Any questions before we start? Okay, if you could do me a favor, I'm first pull out this little, very short little article I had you read by David Perry called The Global Distribution of AIDS Pharmaceuticals. It's the one that's from the Markkula Center. I had you read this, not because it's a particularly dense or sophisticated article, but because of the fact that it's sort of, let's start with a nice little overview of what were the first and what are the sort of the more basic sort of ways in which we see AIDS encountering international sort of healthcare bioethics. So turning to page 2 in this document. Oh, good. I was afraid I wasn't recording. let's just sort of go through this thing and see if we can't sort of pull out some of the important sort of terms here. So, let's see here. How should we do this? I want to sort of, like I said, make a cheat sheet on the board for us to help us with that exercise we're doing later. So, this is going to be our section where we're going to sort of list what the principles or duties are that require us to have concerns on a global scale about HIV and AIDS. And then maybe over here, this can be our issues place where we list what are some of the actual concerns we have in question. So the top of page 2 on this article, it lists a couple of principles to begin with, right? And those are, somebody see them? Mm-hmm. Yes, where are they? This here, compassion, and fairness. Now I should put my cards on the table and just say right off the bat, I'm not a huge principles person when it comes to bioethics. Not that I don't think they're valuable. For me, the problem is always the fact that you can isolate a principle or several principles in a moment where it's bioethically significant. But quite often, principles tend to be in competition with one another rather than in cahoots with one another, and so one is sort of stuck where one began with. Nevertheless, isolating what are the actual motivations that are providing our interest is a good place to go. Compassion and fairness, to me, seem to be very good places to start. Any other thoughts on principles to apply here? And if you can't think of any right now, doesn't matter. You can shoot them out later in the class. Okay. Let's first look at the three reasons why it's listed here about we should be morally obligated to help people on a global scale who are HIV positive. This is on the middle of the second page. Mm-hmm. Does somebody want to take paragraph number 4? It's called First, a Very Large Number. Can I get someone to read that out loud for me? Great.
First, a very large number of those who have died from HIV/AIDS or are living with the disease cannot possibly be blamed for their fate. Nearly 5 million AIDS victims are children who obviously did not choose to be born HIV positive. And many other victims are married women who have been faithful to their husbands but became infected anyway because their husbands had unsafe sex with prostitutes. Many wives don't find out that their husbands are infected until they give birth to HIV positive children.
Okay, these are three reasons about, like, when people put up the excuse or their explanation, you know, most people get HIV, get it through some kind of unsafe sexual practice. These are the three sort of retorts for why that doesn't mean we shouldn't help people on a large scale. The first retort is basically what? It's a paraphrase we just heard.
That not everyone should be blamed for it.
Yeah, okay, so it's like this. It's like saying, you know, most people who have HIV sort of got it through some sort of unsafe sort of behavior. But I have three rejoinders to tell you why that shouldn't help us. First of all, not everybody's in that category. That's what the first point is. The second one, somebody want to read this for us?
The second reason why we shouldn't assume we have no moral obligations to people with HIV/AIDS is that in other cases, even when we know that people acquire a medical condition due to their own irresponsibility, we don't deny them medical care for that reason. For example, everybody knows that it's foolish to ride a motorcycle without a helmet. But if a motorcycle rider has a serious accident while not wearing a helmet, we don't refuse to provide emergency and rehabilitative treatment. The same principle ought to apply for people who are infected with HIV through their own carelessness. They should not be denied care on that basis alone.
Okay, so summarize that for me then, somebody. Shouldn't be judgmental, and you should apply the same standard that you would for any other kind of risk as you would in this particular scenario, which is to say, it is absolutely understandable why, in the face of a pandemic, we have deemed unsafe sex to be a particularly morally culpable sort of thing, a thing that causes us concern. But the truth of the matter is, AIDS did not create the notion of unhealthy risk itself. That has existed forever. And to that degree, we don't deny other people who do unsafe or risky behavior actual care. We may chastise them post the fact by, you should really wear a helmet or something like that, or try to advise people in advance of those kinds of actions, but we don't deny them care, is the second reason. Which is to say, though, of these three reasons, the first reason says that not everybody falls into that camp of doing this to themselves. In some cases, they had it thrust upon them, so we should have compassion for them. The second reason is saying that we should provide this care for people who do other kinds of risky behaviors, so we need to have fairness then in the way that we do it. Number three says, and third, we are citizens of a wealthy country and should not turn away from the suffering of the poor. Like the person who was helped by the Samaritan in the parable of Jesus,
people living with HIV AIDS are our neighbors in need. I don't think we have to live up to the standard of Jesus Christ to do the right thing in any particular moment. Having said that, the point is well noted in the sense that, like, sometimes we do it just because it's the right thing to do. Because not because someone didn't deserve it or because somebody was like somebody else who was risky, but just because someone was human to begin with. And if we have the means with which to help, then perhaps we should. So this is a very sort of basic point that's being made here, but nevertheless one that's good to start on, which is to say those who have pause or hesitation about how we should take an investment or interest internationally in the status of people of HIV and AIDS, this is our sort of rebuke to that sort of discussion. Turn the page to page 3 then. This is where we're going to get to sort of talking about some of the issues that are involved here. Top of page 3, the first full paragraph, ends with the sentence, "Why can't companies like Pfizer cover the cost of AIDS drugs with the profits they make on other drugs?" So let's just read through a couple of these paragraphs and I'll take this on. Critics of the pharmaceutical industry also point out that their research is often funded by government grants rather than private investment alone. It doesn't seem fair for companies to make big profits on drugs needed to promote public health, especially when the public health has already paid in part for the cost of developing those drugs and often pays for them again through federal health programs like Medicaid. Critics also believe that companies could charge much less for their drugs if they spent less on marketing and advertising, which by some estimates is nearly 3 times the amount they spend on drug research and development. Corporations holding patents on AIDS-related drugs have strongly criticized by developing country governments and groups such as AIDS Action for the high prices they charge. Some governments such as South Africa, India, and Brazil have allowed other companies to infringe foreign patents and produce their own versions of AIDS drugs, in many cases at substantially lower prices. According to New York Times reporter Daniel McNeil Jr., some of the major pharmaceutical companies responded to those pressures last year by substantially lowering the prices of their drugs in selected countries. But 39 of those companies also sued the government of South Africa in an effort to protect their patents. And the next paragraph says, in a dramatic twist, turn of events, those companies decided not to sue in the end those particular countries. Skipping to the next paragraph. On the other hand, it's not clear that allowing patent infringements is wise in the long term. It sets a bad precedent under international treaties for the protection of intellectual property, and it could be counterproductive if it makes companies less likely to invest in new drugs to treat other infectious diseases. Also, if in the future pharmaceutical companies are going to be expected to charge little or nothing for HIV-related drugs in developing countries, they're going to have to recoup the cost of developing those drugs elsewhere. As a result, they may be unable to significantly reduce the prices of drugs that we might consider essential for treating diabetes, cancer, depression, pain, and other debilitating diseases or conditions. So, this is going to set us up for what we're going to turn to now, which is the next article by Udo Schuchling, which is called AIDS, Bioethics, and Public Policy. This is going to get to some of the issues that we're talking about. What's briefly mentioned in that article we just said before was basically turning towards the drug companies and the responsibility that we have here. So some of the things to take note just from that first moment we'll talk more about in the beginning of the article are about whether or not this is a public or private responsibility. And part of that comes from both how the distribution and dissemination of these drugs internationally happen, but also the cost of them as well. There's a mention also as much too about here, cost and the respect of a patent, which is also then with respect to intellectual property. My point, of course, is that we're going to have several more principles over here, too, and that quite often principles of fairness and compassion, for example, compete when we get to thinking about how they apply to each of these issues. So I want us to sort of keep adding to this list. Udo's article I want to jump to real quick because it's actually quite good at systematically going through some of the concerns that we have here. The bottom of the first page of the piece, AIDS, Bioethics, and Public Policy, is talking about that there's nothing new about a correlation between poverty and ill health, it says at the bottom of this article. What's new, and we've talked a lot about this semester, is the fact that this is sort of a big word for us in terms of thinking about international AIDS policy. It's that not that AIDS comes along as a pandemic of a deadly sort of degree, because those are the cases for all time, but AIDS comes at a period
where we really have globalization sort of beginning in place. Does everybody know what we're talking about when we say globalization?
If you think you do, just shoot out a couple ideas.
The internet.
The internet is is one example. What's another example of globalization?
Easy, cheap travel.
Easy, cheap travel. Travel itself.
Yeah.
You know, the world getting smaller because travel is faster.
Free trade.
Free trade, absolutely. Whether that's global, whether that's North American. Remember we heard about NAFTA all the time in the 90s, you know, this idea of work going south of the border. It's an example of globalization. Free market, higher trade, import-export. These are all examples of globalization. Now, this kind of international sort of connection is as old as nations themselves are, but the degree to which the world is smaller, more closely connected, and our daily lives affect one another has been exaggerated with each passing year of the last 20 and 21st centuries, to the point where the real crux of the end of the 20th century was, is this a good or a bad thing, that we're getting this interconnected? It's making things cheaper, but it's also sending work overseas. You know, we're getting access to more products, but then we can't control the standards of those products because there's different jurisdictions. You know, we're allowed to have the best of what we want from throughout the world, but it also means those with the least are still stuck, and sometimes in many cases with even worse conditions because they have no bargaining power anymore locally because they've lost it because of globalization, and on and on. The thing being then that AIDS comes along, this deadly communicable disease, at a moment where the world has become more interconnected and smaller than it ever has before. So the ironic historical the ironic thing about the history of AIDS then is the fact that it comes not just and hits a few vulnerable communities, as we've talked about, but also that it hits a planet, a globe, the world, at a time when it's more interconnected than ever. Thus, the questions we have today about responsibility, epidemiologically, public health-wise, are in many ways just echoes of the conversations we've been having for 20 or 30 years about globalization. How much do we have a responsibility to each other? How much is a person living in Uganda really my brother, or are they actually somebody of a different nation? To what degree do I owe a responsibility to serve, protect, help, enable another country? To that degree, what we're talking about here, and this is why the syllabus says this, is that in many ways, what has played out over the latter part of the 20th century in diplomacy, we could say, is really what AIDS international discourse is kind of about. It's just ironic in the sense that both the spread of the disease itself was made possible by globalization, and the hindrances towards the treatment, prevention, and education of the disease globally have globalization as a sort of aid or culprit at the same time. Thus, the strange interconnection of many peoples across many lands in the world is both the history of the disease of AIDS and also of its hopeful sort of eradication. Yeah.
I just had a question as far as the drug policies and drug companies in other countries. Are they similarly set up to the U.S. as far as, I guess, being kind of private companies and they're able to hold patents?
Some, not all of them. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
That's why we talk about some of these countries that do patent infringement.
Yeah.
Quite often they have subsidized or federal actual drug companies that are actually making sort of generic duplicate sort of versions of other drugs that we have. Yeah. So it varies. And in fact, I think it's the ones that either have a cheap possibility privately or one that can be subsidized publicly that are the ones that are allowing these infringements of drugs.
Gotcha.
Okay. Also, they happen to be the ones that can't afford them at American prices, too. Absolutely. Right. So the good thing to take home is to note that there is absolutely great disparity and difference between how drug companies work in different countries.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. If the policies were all the same internationally, one could think that the economics of some countries are rich and some countries are poor would still be an obstacle, but it would be aided by the fact that, well, we have the same policies, though. But the truth is, some countries are rich and some countries are not, and some countries are very poor, and they all have very different sort of drug policies. Some have some similarities, but they're all going to be different in some ways. And so it's both of those things combined that add to the sort of hindrance that we have here. But that's a good question. Okay, so Udo had us think then about globalization at the beginning of that piece. Turn to the next page, 128. In this paragraph, it's called Introduction. So, and this introduction is basically sort of your basic sort of like, here's what bioethics had to say about AIDS in the first few days. And this is something we talked about from the first class we've had. But he does a nice job in a sentence here in the middle, about 10 lines down, that says, the initial areas of concern and inquiry focused on, and these he's saying are the first areas and issues we're interested with AIDS, informed consent to HIV testing and trial participation, the confidentiality of HIV test results, access to trials as a means of access to experimental drugs, the length of time it took to get an experimental drug to the market approval stage, and end-of-life decision-making. Those of you who are bioethics students or have taken other bioethics classes can see that if you pull out the AIDS words in that particular paragraph, it's just a chock-a-block full of sort of your classic bioethics sort of like issues. So the initial... areas of concern. Can somebody read them out to me again? I'll write them down. In that paragraph?
Informed consent.
Thank you. Informed consent.
Confidentiality of test results.
Confidentiality.
Access to trials as a means of access to experimental drugs.
Mm-hmm.
How the length of time it took to get an experimental drug to the market approval stage. And then end of life decision making.
Okay. So we could end today's class, and I can wipe down every board and leave this up here, and no one would know what bioethics class we were talking about. That's sort of like a hit list of like the classic things. So,
which is to say that initial investment and interest in AIDS really did peak from the fact that here was an illness, here was a disease that actually spoke to long-standing bioethical sort of principles and questions and concerns. Having said that, the turn towards globalization, turn towards international policies on HIV and AIDS shows that that list still persists, but we're going to add to it now on the board at the end of the hall to show that it's actually become much more robust with lots of other concerns that are in place. Turning the page then on page 129, we start to get a little bit of a list here. Okay, so in the middle of this paragraph he writes, however, in ethically important ways, they are dwarfed by concerns over, and these are some of the new concerns we have. Drug prices, which is here. Next, intellectual property rights, up here, affordable, again, access to essential AIDS drugs. Moving down the paragraph, he writes, standards of clinical care. Some of these are going to sound familiar to you from last week when we talked about PrEP and PEP and how those issues were sort of informed. Post-trial care, community benefits, and of course it's opposite too. We talked about ways in which a drug trial coming in is always a good thing for a community in the way that it can distract from other services and needs. Access, then not just to affordable drugs, but to the trial itself. And I would say, I'm going to add bureaucracy to this list of things, as well as two more. And these are all things that are concerns or things that dovetail when we talk about AIDS policy. Diplomacy and charity. I list them there not because they're bad things, but because of the fact that quite often the difficulty in determining how to determine an AIDS public health policy with another country is complicated by the fact that it can be either directed through the channels of or complicated by a political relationship, an economical relationship, or a charitable relationship that one country has with another. And it's the need to either want to use or circumvent those particular channels that can also provide a kind of inroads or its opposite. Any questions or anything else you want to throw up there on that board?
Well, I don't know if we'll cover this later, but I think that obviously, depending on the country, access to health care, just in general, like even in the U.S., we don't have insurance, and I think a lot of probably poor people with HIV or AIDS don't, unless they can get Medicaid.
And let's just put down the standard of health care.
Yeah.
And by standard, I don't know where the bar is set, but I mean, like, what is the standard way in which medicine is disseminated within a particular country? Is there socialized medicine, or is there not? Is there insurance, or is there not? Is there access, or not? Clinics, hospitals, etc.
I think that
comes
to be a principle of duty.
Okay, which is?
Health, right to health care.
In fact, quite often in many international, from including the UN and UNESCO and other countries, the basic human rights for many countries include the right to live a healthy life. You just don't have it in the United States because that would imply the fact that we have to have government mandated insurance. But yeah, it's an actual human right in many places. One that actually provides a lot of head scratching from some countries about why, for example, to use the United States as an example, there isn't intervention for healthcare because that's a standard right, so why wouldn't you want to help, so to speak? But it's a difference in principles and policies also. Anybody else have another principle they want to throw up there?
Well, I mean, they all are like justice.
Justice.
That's good.
Justice.
In what way?
In what way what?
The justice, like
I think it's fairness.
Allocation of justice.
They're similar, but I think the justice one is good because it also speaks to where we talk about fairness is complicated with when it comes to what about the drug company's rights? You know, what about the intellectual rights that they have to have them stripped away or not, so to speak? One would certainly say that in a certain technical sense, it would be unjust to circumvent what are actual legal protections that the company has. And this is sort of the point that was talked about in terms of the dangerous precedent that's set sometimes when you think about things like destabilizing a patent or something like that, which we'll talk about in a second. Anybody else have a comment?
No? Okay, let's look at a couple of these examples then. Let's see here. On page 138, let's read about one of these cases that's talked about. This might give us actually some meat on the bones to talk a bit more about what these principles we're throwing up on the board are. Up until now, I've been talking kind of abstractly. So this is the paragraph that's under research ethics. I'm going to read the first paragraph. Do you want to take the second one? And then we'll sort of work our way down. An acrimonious and lengthy international debate on the ethically appropriate standards of care provided in clinical trials in developing countries was triggered by an AIDS trial that took place in South Africa, among other countries. The trial in question was responding to a perceived need in developing countries to investigate a potentially affordable medication that might reduce the transmission of HIV from a pregnant infected woman to her offspring. Before the trial started, a trial undertaken only in developed countries had established that 25% of HIV-infected pregnant women who use no antiretroviral medication transmit the virus to their offspring. But less than 8% of those who used a particular regimen of the drug, zidovudine, do. Not unexpectedly, this trial regime soon became the gold standard for mother-to-child transmission prevention in the developed world. We talked a bit about this last week when we were talking about where PrEP trials came from. Basically, this study is saying that take antiretrovirals if you're a pregnant woman, 25% chance, 8% chance, less than, that you're going to give the disease to your child. But if you don't, greater than 25% chance. Okay. Unfortunately, this drug regime proved to be unaffordable for the majority of infected women in developing countries. The developing world trial aimed at testing a cheaper yet effective MTCT regime. In order to do so, the investigators sought to establish not whether a lower dosage was efficient, as efficient as the higher one provided in the developed world, but whether it was more efficient than doing nothing. In other words, the test was matched against a placebo control. Because the developed world standard of care was unaffordable to developing country public health systems, this was effectively no drug at all. So everybody understand the scenario we're talking about here. So a study in a developed multi-country determines these results about the 8% versus 25%. It's unaffordable, though, that standard of care, to do it in a developing country or a country that can't help fund that particular kind of work. So a second study is to be performed, and this one is not following the normal protocol that has been set down, which is to say, if you want to see, if we know what a gold standard is, if we have a standard of what the care is, and you want to see if less than works, you need to compare it to the standard. You have to compare up, is what it's saying. They wanted to do a study that compared down. Is doing half as much of a drug better than doing of the top drug better than nothing, or rather than saying it's half the drug better than the full amount of the drug is what's happening. So it's going against what the sort of protocol for testing is here, and this is the concern. Okay, go ahead.
The trial regime was quickly denounced in international medical as well as bioethics journals because it violated a standard provision of the world's pivotal research ethics guideline, the World Medical Association's Declaration of Helsinki. The Helsinki Declaration would have required the developing world investigators to compare their trial regime against the existing gold standard of HIV MTCT prevention, the locally unaffordable regime. High-profile defenders of the trial in question argued that the Helsinki Declaration was not a particularly useful ethical yardstick to hold the developing world-based trial against. They proposed adjusting the declaration to the realities of developing world healthcare. At the heart of their analysis were two ethical arguments. The first argument was that women in the trials in question were no worse off by virtue of their trial participation. The participating pregnant women would not have had access to antiretrovirals at all in the public healthcare sector of their countries. Hence, those in the placebo arm were not any worse off, while those in the active agent arm were almost certainly better off. The second argument states, in a nutshell, that the Helsinki requirement to test a new experimental agent always against the best proven diagnostic and therapeutic method of treatment is preventing useful research in developing countries. If one always has to test a new agent against the best medication that exists somewhere in the world, no matter what people in a given location can access or afford it, one would not be able to investigate cheaper treatment regimes that could actually make a difference in the developing country.
The counterarguments employee questioned the need to develop cheaper drugs, asking whether or not there is such a thing as the natural in a sense of not subjected to human choices. Price for any given medication. Proponents of this point of view argue that the prices people pay for essential drugs are the result of pricing decisions made by major multinational pharmaceutical corporations. Solutions to the matter of drug pricing then could be so in internationally accepted regulations, so as the World Trade Organization's TRIPS agreement, which allows for compulsory licensing and parallel importation of essential drugs in cases of public health emergencies. This obviously will eliminate a lot of the persuasive power of the position I had just described. If it is possible to simply compulsory remove the patent protection of essential AIDS drugs, and as a corollary of this, their high price tag, the need to develop cheaper AIDS drugs for developing countries may well all but disappear. Arguably, however, this will not solve other issues, so as the lack of systems for the delivery of antiretroviral drugs in many developing countries. The success of such treatment regimes relies on the regular counts of certain blood cells, satisfactory levels of nutrition, and so on and so forth. Still, it is widely accepted that the drug price is one of the primary hindrances of poor people's access to essential AIDS drugs. One may even argue that prices for diagnostic instruments could be subject to a critique similar to that deployed against high prices for patented drugs. I shall have a closer look at this issue in the next and penultimate section of this article.
Okay, let's stop there. Okay, so thinking about this case then and the way in which the study was first done, what's the dilemma we have here then? This study where they were going to do a trial someplace using less than the full gold standard treatment that had been fortified and testing it against nothing. What's in ethical dispute there?
The fact that it violates that Helsinki requirement.
So everybody know this Helsinki code requirement? I mean, it's very famous. It's sort of like the sort of go-to text. It sort of first came about many years after the Nuremberg trials and has been updated on regularly, but it's sort of the go-to on what we see as not just basic healthcare and research science rights, but almost a kind of human rights as well, too. So your point, I'm sorry, again, was that it violates this Helsinki code and therefore violates one of the sort of like central sort of like litmus tests, if you will, for what's the right standard to do. And how does it violate it?
Because instead of comparing an experimental trial to a previously established one, it compares it to a placebo.
Right, good. And the idea then being that what's being set up here then, and what's at stake here, what's at loggerheads, is this idea that there is an attempt to want to circumvent the normal standard so that we can still do something in a place where it's unaffordable, rather than having to live up to the gold standard if that means we can't do anything in a particular moment for a certain price. So to that end, what's being talked about here by Udo Schickling here is providing is a dilemma where a bioethical quandary is really one where there's a tension between what we ethically say we're supposed to do versus what is practically actually possible to do. And in that sense, this moment here with the unaffordability of this particular care sets up the question about whether or not, well, do we compromise the ethics a bit in order to practically make possible the study that happens, or do we respect the ethics of it and try to think about the practical something that's perhaps not possible. Looking on page 139, in defense of the idea that one should, compromise one's ethical values and provide a study according to that particular standards, there were two reasons that were given. The first was that the women in question would be no worse off, which is to say, if they're given less than the gold standard of care compared to nothing, it's better than just having them all get nothing, so to speak, was one explanation. And the second one was that this Helsinki requirement, if it's supposed to be an ethical, moral sort of barometer for us, but it goes so far that it prevents care entirely in a particular region, then maybe it's ethically too high. The bar is being set by that particular standard. The counter-argument we get is in the next paragraph, this counter-argument, which basically says that if the affordability is the problem here, it's not the fact that we're concerned about the scientific protocol that seems to be the bioethical concern, but it's really the affordability that's impeding us here, then maybe there is an economic solution for this particular problem. And one of those economic solutions is this one that we talked about with patents. Lowering not respecting the patent intellectual property rights of a particular drug so that another country could create their own without having to use the actual drug company. Now, if you look back at that article that we first started with, this one from the Markkula Center, it lists a couple of reasons why this is a dangerous policy. I'm going to link them up to what are some ones that Udo also gives. So on page 3 of that first article, it lists 3 reasons why breaking a patent internationally for the benefit of providing affordable drugs to a country that can't afford the traditional gold standard regime that we talked about, it gives 3 reasons why this is sort of risky. The first is it says it sets a bad precedent under international treaties for the protection of international intellectual property. So one reason to have pause about breaking a patent or intellectual property agreement when it comes to AIDS drugs is the sense that it's not so bad what it does for these drugs, because clearly there's a great outcome, it's going to save people's lives. What precedent does that mean for the fact that people can now start reprinting books and t-shirts and Mickey Mouse gear and government documents and whatever the hell they want? Because we've sort of opened the floodgates to this idea that patents are not a strict thing we hold people to internationally. And it certainly means that people could try to break all kinds of intellectual, political, economical sort of like patents if they could just bring a case that, well, in some cases there's a life and death question that depends upon it. That's a very tricky slippery slope. So that's one thing that's being set up. Yeah.
Don't we have time limits on patents for drugs?
We do, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the hard part about that, this is one of the big stresses, is the fact that people are just, in international countries, know that I don't have the time to wait for that patent to run out, so to speak. But we absolutely know that patents have a time limit in terms of how long, for example, we know that the drugs, when they're first synthesized and put onto the market, are very expensive, and it's only several years later that we can actually go to our pharmacist and say, give me the generic option, instead. It's in that window where we don't have the generic option that a lot of the supplies do, so that's a good distinction to make. The second thing that's listed here as a concern is that this kind of patent breaking could be counterproductive if it makes companies less likely to invest in new drugs. So in other words, it would be a bad side effect if, yes, a drug could go international and a patent could be broken and could be provided cheaper in poorer countries. But if that means the drug company back home is like, well, then we're getting out of the business of making more AIDS drugs, then that suggests a bad precedent down the road in that particular avenue. All of these things are not just to win one way or the other, but to show it's a very slippery slope about what to do in these moments. And the third reason that's listed here in this second to last paragraph on page 3 is it says they're going to have to recoup the cost somewhere else.
So the money that can't be used to pay those prices overseas means it's going to cause a problem in the sense that it might make them more, even more expensive than they already are here at home, so to speak. So that's a third concern. A fourth one that's brought up by Udo Schuklenk in this paragraph that we just looked at, though, is it says, the need to develop cheaper AIDS drugs for developing countries would then disappear, which is to say this. Drugs need to get cheaper internationally regardless. And to break a patent in a particular country so that country can synthesize its own drug treatment to provide cheaper care for its people is a good solution, except for the fact that it means that there's no pressure then to make the drugs cheaper for anybody else internationally. So while it can help certain countries that are willing to kind of go rogue and break with diplomacy and policy, and that thing about setting a bad precedent, let's not forget the way in which breaking a patent could actually have harmful political consequences. Those countries can do well in the short run, but it actually screws over a lot of countries in between. My point is not that patent breaking can't be a good, viable solution. It absolutely is in certain moments and certain in certain extreme chances. I'm just laying out for you the sort of like caveats that people have attached towards that particular practice. Yeah.
But for example, in Brazil, they decide to go no matter what, and they have been very successful. And also what they decide to do is get the selected people at the university to concentrate more research. So
yeah.
The country can do the research.
You can do it. You can do it, yeah. And in some ways, that actual ability to break a patent and have a country start to try to synthesize its own drugs can actually also simultaneously stimulate a kind of research protocol in that very country. It can't have that side effect. On the other hand, there have been many examples where a country has broken a patent law and has had great results when it came towards its treatment of HIV and AIDS in a short period of time, but some other crisis, usually of a natural disaster variety, sort of comes along, and there's a hard part with the diplomacy that comes with that because of the previous sort of like relationship. My point is not, like I said, to poo-poo any of these strategies, just to kind of speak to the way in which this is very fraught terrain. And the terrain is all just bearing the harbingers of just this. It's just globalization over and over again, this difficult diplomacy that has to happen. The question is here, we're not talking about exchanging Chevy Chevettes, you know, or Sony TVs. I mean, this is about drug care for people internationally.
But also something that can be done with patents is sometimes when you are filed for a patent, they have these lawyers and all this infrastructure to cover so much that sometimes it's impossible to touch it. I mean, to infringe in some of these conditions just for the benefit of the population, I think that will make a solution without completely, because you have so many claims in one single patent that, I mean, to sort between those claims and to allow.
And the complexity of those patents also speaks to this is the way in which internationally a lot of people get screwed, which is to say they had no part in being a part of the government or the policies that were made that created the standards of those patents. And yet, for those who are not in the United States or Germany or countries that are producing these AIDS drugs, that we are all beholden to those domestic patent sort of standards. To that degree, it leaves sort of in shackles people who had no connection whatsoever towards the standard of intellectual properties, say, in the United States, but yet who are beholden to those particular drugs that they need for their own care. So it becomes a very sort of tricky sort of way in which what seems to be domestic policy has now, because of globalization, come to be international policy. And this happens time and time and time again, so to speak. The hard part about when it comes to HIV and AIDS is, of course, the urgency with which this particular kind of care happens. And this is the part where I talk about, you know, diplomacy, charity, economics, politics, they all seem to be different avenues that are informed by the way that we can talk about this issue. I spent a lot of time this summer, and we've talked a lot about the way in which AIDS has many different levels of signification in the way that it's not just epidemiological, it's cultural, it's sexual, it's historical, it's political, it's economical. And this is yet another example of where we see that actually in a very, maybe perhaps its most literal sort of manifestation. The way with which we are able to disseminate care and treatment to people internationally for HIV and AIDS is all of those things sort of simultaneously. And it's the ability to please all of those masters at once that's the hard thing. So thus, patent breaking is really an example of I'm going to speak to the epidemiological and humane and sort of like urgent needs that are trumping, I think, the political and economic ones in this particular moment, or vice versa. So the ability to not be able to honor all of those things equally simultaneously is what makes it hard to do this kind of international aid sort of work. Let's turn to the last page of Wu's article, because I am kind of anxious to get through this exercise. Kind of repeats that on page 141 in this last section, access to essential AIDS drugs. is a relationship between intellectual property rights, patent protection, drug prices, and access to essential drugs for the poor. It's trying to figure out in these categories of compassion, fairness, rights, justice, which of these wins out in which particular time and which particular circumstance, because it's hard to honor equally the sense of justice and fairness when it comes to intellectual property rights versus access to essential drugs. Those two seem to compete, so it's weighing those two in a moment. I'd like to have you look at the last paragraph of this section, though, because he writes here, "What is interesting with regard to this debate is that bioethicists have moved on from arguments suggesting that pharmaceutical multinationals should provide some donations to worthy projects and engaged in argument at a policy level. The discussion, in other words, is no longer operating on the usual ethics level of please do the right thing and investigating what is the right thing to do. Rather, it has moved on to proactive policy development." Anybody want to take a stab at paraphrasing that? And I don't have the answer to this one either, because I'm kind of stumped by this a little bit. I think it's supposed to be the meat of this article, but it's sort of set in a blip, and then the article is over, so to speak. Yeah?
I'm not sure, but I think it just means, like, instead of, like, just being passive and expecting, like, drug companies and policymakers to do the right thing or to, you know, give X amount to charity, that there's... that the push now is for people to decide exactly what the right thing to do and create policy in that area.
Yeah.
And then let the chips fall.
I think that's a very good way to put it, which is to say, instead of pleading for the right thing to be done by a certain government or drug company or what have you, in the face of these obstacles, the largest one probably being affordability to disseminate this care. So instead of pleading, just please swallow the cost of it, whatever, let's try to find solutions. Which is to say, this idea of proactive policy development, if you want to circle that phrase, that's the big one. I think the truth is, the idea of breaking a patent internationally, what that was it was an attempt to provide a proactive policy development. Yeah. And the response is then, we've gone through all the reasons why breaking a patent can be hard and difficult, yet it can still work. But maybe it's not that that's the solution, but rather that that's the kind of solution that might need to happen internationally. In the face of how expensive drugs are, what are some policy decisions that can be made that can circumvent that international problem, rather than having to lean on the chance that we have to use charity in some way to compel people to want to give drugs? Yeah?
If we're calling it policy, does that imply that it's not voluntary as well?
It's not voluntary?
Right.
Well, I think the hope is that it's voluntary. I mean, this is thinking about basic diplomacy, you know, but that the possibility that it might not be is certainly one as well, too, which is to say we either need to have cooperation with the drug companies and governments or what have you to make this somehow affordable and or close to affordable in some sort of way, or we have to create loopholes in some way that are the least offensive, the least unethical in some way to provide the care that needs to happen. Because I think everyone sort of feels like the worst thing to have is that no one receives any care of any kind. That does absolutely mean that the bar might be too high. And to that end, how in policy, and sometimes negotiation, sometimes not, how can we circumvent that? Anybody? Hand up? No? Okay, let's look at a couple of examples real quick at some of this sort of like policy sort of work. If you pull out the Jennifer Breyer article, "We Struggle Against It Together." Jennifer Breyer's book is called Infectious AIDS. It's a very good book. It's basically about sort of what is the politics of AIDS nationally and internationally from the United States perspective. talking a lot about dispelling misconceptions that we might have about the way in which we see political movements working in the United States related towards HIV and AIDS, which is to say her argument is that a lot of the work that we've been doing has been showing that AIDS activism is actually very political in the way that it's happening, not just the fact that it's happening on a public health sort of level. One of the major arguments that she makes in that book, and this is sort of a side note, but it's kind of an interesting one, is that the common history that we've sort of been told about American sort of reaction to AIDS in the 1980s, especially during the Reagan administration, is that there was great consensus among conservative persons that they had great distaste for people with AIDS, didn't want to help them, didn't want to support them, didn't want to fund them. And we often use as the point of that fact that the Reagan administration, Reagan himself, never said the word AIDS until 1987, 6 years after it started, so to speak. So 6 years, there was no statement, no policy made, and that's supposed to be evidence of the fact that
there was little support on the conservative side towards people with AIDS. Jennifer Breyer's argument is kind of quite interesting, and she does a good job of convincing of that, which is to say that the fact that there was nothing said about AIDS by these administrations actually shows that there was no consensus. In other words, if there was great consensus among conservative persons that, you know, AIDS was something that was awful, then the government would feel free to make and say awful policies. But they knew that it was a contentious, debatable issue, and therefore there was great division and different divisive sort of opinions. That's her basic argument. My point is the fact that she is interested in rereading the way in which we look at the history of AIDS in the United States and internationally. Thus, this piece she has here on South Africa is an attempt to see the way in which activism connected towards policy, which is this very thing that Udo was talking about that we moved towards, what was the phrase he used? Proactive policy development. Mm-hmm. And proactive policy development includes a sort of proactive movement on the part of people who are being activists for AIDS. She wants us to look at this particular work that's happening in South Africa, according to this group, the South African AIDS Alliance, and to see how the work that they're doing is actually motivated by a political and economic urgency, not just the standard way in which we see AIDS activism happening domestically. Thus, the part we're going to get to in a second is the fact that, like, a lot of people want to turn towards AIDS activism internationally in lots of different countries and say that it was in many ways inspired and modeled on the way that it was done in the United States or United Kingdom or someplace like that, in particular through gay communities. And Breyer's argument is that a little bit, but not entirely, is sort of her point. Thus, it's this attempt to, because of poverty, because of political strife and turmoil, because of not being in a country that's developing these very drugs, what's happened is that AIDS activism takes on this very proactive policy development sort of strategy, which is kind of different than you would find in the United States. So this is on page 190. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to read a couple of these paragraphs out loud so we can hear another example in front of us about what we're looking at with these proactive developments. 4 years after the announcement in Vancouver about protease inhibitors at the 13th International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa, 5,000 people participated in the global march for HIV/AIDS treatment, hoping to secure antiretroviral drugs, ARVs, of which protease inhibitors were a particular class, for all people with AIDS in the global south. The marchers' position on drug treatment for HIV/AIDS existed in direct opposition to the claims of the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, who rejected ARVs as dangerous and questioned the link between HIV and AIDS. But the protesters, most of whom came from two organizations, Treatment Action Campaign, an AIDS activist organization less than 2 years old, and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the largest trade union federation in the country, also knew that Mbeki could not be their only target. They carried posters that pictured a bloody hand coupled with the phrases, "One AIDS death every 10 minutes, affordable drugs now." To attain their goal of treatment access, protesters demanded research be redirected from the global north to poor countries and communities. Not only would this end profiteering by the pharmaceutical companies and make distribution of drugs more possible, but it would also sustain development and help women and children cope with HIV/AIDS. By combining forces, TAC and COSATU articulated a shared project between people with AIDS and people committed to a global class struggle. The AIDS Alliance, as it's been called, solidified an argument that refused the dichotomy between the availability of treatment and the economic equality required to access that treatment. And it also mobilized people to create alternative AIDS services in the face of an active state. The need to connect AIDS and economic development grew out of the deep connection between AIDS and poverty. By 2000, just under a quarter of the South African population was infected with HIV. This was double the number of people infected in 1997. The rates of poverty were equally dramatic. By 2001, approximately 57% of the South African population lived below the poverty line. This percentage had not changed since 1996, the first time the national statistics were collected in a democratic South Africa. And at the Durban conference, South African politicians, trade unionists, and AIDS activists faced the twin problems of HIV infection and poverty in ways that called attention to the links between the historical struggles against state-sponsored racial and economic inequality. The case of South African AIDS activism emerged, and the course that activism took after the discovery of effective treatment for AIDS puts U.S. AIDS work in sharp relief, particularly in terms of how changes take place on a local and global level. Instead of seeing the South African case as a direct descendant of AIDS, of U.S. activism,
A tempting choice given the link between the style of protest used by Tak and Kwasatu, as well as the similarities between the images carried by protesters. That bloody hand on a, with the words, and it's on the last page, there was an ACT UP poster in the United States a couple years prior that said, like, Reagan administration, you've got blood on your hands, and it looks just like that. So she's saying there's a tempting desire to want to see these two projects doing the same work, given that iconography. But the historical connection more rapidly should be made to the Southern AIDS Workers Fund by the Ford Foundation in the late 1980s and 1990s. In both cases, AIDS workers defined solutions to AIDS as broader than education, direct action, and advocacy. Instead, they centered on eliminating economic inequality as the only way to ensure health. This strategy of putting health within a political economic framework is why a book about the history of U.S. AIDS work in the late 20th century must end not in New York, but in Durban. To a certain extent, South African AIDS activism, which grew out of a long tradition of protest, succeeded where American activism failed, in a challenge to capitalist medicine through attention to poverty and disease simultaneously. What's being suggested then here is that what we're talking about when we need to find these proactive policy developments, when we need to think about AIDS activism internationally, is to see that we absolutely carry with us the host of stigmatizing, epidemiological, critical, vital sort of concerns that we had with AIDS activism when it was at the United States sort of level. But what we're actually bringing into it is an actual long-standing economic concern and a socio-political economic concern about poverty, about the need that we need to address and will never be able to adequately provide the services epidemiologically or public health for people unless we can address the problem of poverty. Thus, the examples that come up about the unaffordability of a certain trial or the inability to provide the gold standard of drugs to countries aren't just about pharmaceutical greed, and they aren't just about economic differences. They're about the strains and constraints that are provided by poverty. A poverty that in many cases has existed for hundreds of years and has only been exacerbated by globalization. Which is to say, one of the unfortunate things that happens about AIDS when it comes along is that globalization has not just made possible the spread of the disease, but globalization has actually, in so many cases, made the quality of life poorer in some of the poorest countries. Not all, but sometimes it has, which is to say that that has set up for us an economic strain that is with a public health sort of disaster on top of it that can only be resolved by trying to fix some of that underlying economic sort of strain. So I wanted to just point you to this example that Breyer provides for us to show that the proactive policy development, even the form of strategizing as a way to think about international problems and the issues like we have on the board that come with the standards of care, providing services and drugs and testing internationally, really at their heart have an almost kind of like economic sort of obstacle there. Turn to this article called Women and AIDS in Sub-Saharan Africa. I just want to look at one more example. Again, we started with those first two articles to give us the cheat sheet on the board, the questions, the qualities, the concerns, and now we're looking at these two articles just to give us some little examples of where do we see these proactive policy decisions happening. This article is by Nelly Matu, and she's talking about work that's being done throughout Sub-Saharan Africa, particularly as a kind of transnational coalition, if you will, in particular for her work with what's called an African Women Against AIDS organization. This is on page 666 of this article.
Do we have more about the source of the article?
This one? Mm-hmm. It's on the last page. It should be. If you look at the very end.
Oh.
Did it print out?
No. I didn't have, no wonder, okay.
It's on the Blackboard site, so maybe just didn't print that page.
Okay,
but I want to look at an example where what's being talked about here is where some of the healthcare concerns of women related towards testing and AIDS care pertain. But what I want you to take home from this as I read through this section is the way in which the concerns that we have here aren't just of a gendered sort of political sort of cultural sort of one, but they often have at their heart an economic sort of strain that speaks to this sort of enduring problem that we're talking about here. The organization African Women Against AIDS, which I currently chair, is a non-governmental organization that provides advocacy on the plight of African women as they confront AIDS devastation. Page 666. Our founding members were concerned with the Western media representation of AIDS primarily as a sexually transmitted disease without regard to the other factors that are at play. We recognize that AIDS prevention is both personal and political. Effective control will require a change in the economic and social status of women.
women's economic independence, personal autonomy, and control over interpersonal relations, including the power to negotiate sex, must be increased if we are to stop AIDS. The gap that exists between AIDS education and behavior modification can be narrowed only if women's needs are addressed in their entirety. The lessons that were supposedly learned in many of the African countries from family planning programs is that you cannot just go to people and imagine that they are empty vessels waiting to be filled with beautiful information, beautiful as you see it, or that after you give them the information, they will automatically change behavior that puts them at risk. But this lesson does not seem to have been learned. AIDS information is being conveyed in the same manner. Women in Africa are being told about the presence of this new disease. They know that there is this threat, but they are not changing behavior, and the question is why? Women are not being reached. You cannot just go and tell a woman who is hungry, who has a child, who is probably very sick and probably not going to school, leave the income-generating activities that you are working with, leave the development activities that you are working with, and come tomorrow. We want to teach you about AIDS information and education. AIDS, as they see it, is something that may come to me, or it may not come, but the hunger is that I feel is an issue now. It is not a matter of whether it will come or it will not come. When women have such low status, when women are the poorest of the poor in any given society, you cannot go and tell them to protect themselves tomorrow without dealing with where they are today. You cannot lead people into tomorrow without knowing where they are coming from. And that has been a major omission in AIDS work. Our organization, therefore, tries to involve ourselves with where women are now. We take where they are and AIDS information and education and blend the two together so that they stop seeing AIDS as something out there, something they will deal with tomorrow. I'll deal with you when I finish with the hunger. I'll deal with you when I finish with school fees. We deal with them all together because all are part of life and all impact on their lives. UNICEF reported a case from Uganda, which is very badly devastated with AIDS, where women were seen to weep openly when they were told that they tested HIV negative. Negative. Why? They wept because if they had tested positive, their children would have been eligible for school subsidy. As long as they test negative, their children cannot be assisted. That is the context within which women are being told abstractly to protect themselves. If those women who are weeping were told that within that door there is AIDS, or the virus is in that door, what do you think they would do, very likely? Run there? Get infected? Get subsidy? They would give their life so that their children may live. And if we do not want them to continue doing that, if we do not want them to continue engaging in activities that put them at risk, selling sexual favors, sleeping with their husbands even when they know they are coming from towns where they know that they have been exposed to HIV, then we must reach them in compassion as human beings and not just tell them, protect yourselves. Our main objective must be to promote the welfare of rural women throughout the improvement of their health status and quality of life. So I wanted you to read this example, not just because it's interesting and kind of touching too, but the very strategy with which healthcare and AIDS treatment and prevention is being understood and implemented throughout the world internationally, and especially in countries that are unavailable to afford some of the best care, is that the only strategic, effective way to talk about even AIDS and educate about it is to see it as an economic sort of matter. Not to say, I understand that you're coming from an impoverished area and you have some basic human needs in that area, but there's this other thing, AIDS, that you need to know about too that's going on. People know about it. People are getting educated. The hard part is how can you wed these two together? And the thing is, they already are. The policies that we have, the way the disease has been disseminated, the way international policies are created and have been established through globalization, AIDS and economics are already intertwined. So to bring that message home seems to be both the political strategy, the proactive policy agenda that's in place, and also the form of education that seems to be happening in a lot of places internationally. And that's an important sort of take-home message. It's not that AIDS is non-economically enforced when it happens in developed countries, because we can see that money plays a big part in how healthcare works in the richest of countries too. It's that it's imperative in the poorest of countries because it turns out to be the greatest obstacle towards not just the care but also the prevention of the disease too. All right, what I want to do, unless somebody has a question right now, is have us break into those groups to look at these sections, because we looked at a couple of vignettes there, but I kind of want to hear just sort of four
you know, moments, snapshots of places that are dealing with HIV and AIDS and where they are. We're going to look at 1, 2, 3, 4, and let's look at 2, 4, 6,
sorry,
12, that's okay, that's all right, 11, 2, 4, 6, 8, 11, 4, 3, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to count off, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, okay. And let's have group one
be Thailand, group two, Haiti, group three, Zimbabwe, and group four is South Africa. Okay, what I want you to do again is just this. Meet with your group, read over the prose that's provided on that particular country, and look at the images that are provided, and be prepared to come back and to talk to the rest of the group and say, you know, assume that people did read those nuggets last night or a couple days ago, or that they didn't, and just say, let me give you a little bit of a snapshot about what this section is about. It's basically saying, here are the two or three most important sort of ethical and sort of like healthcare concerns that are happening with AIDS in this particular country. Give us a little vignette on that. Tell us what's provided in this prose. Direct us towards a picture if you even want to. There's a good example of this on the third picture in the section, that kind of thing. And then, as you're meeting in your group for the next 20 minutes, I want you to share with the group also, and here's where we are now with Haiti and HIV and AIDS. The most recent numbers from such and such a group show that the HIV infection rate is here. It used to be a problem that it was in this particular population, now it seems to be now. Here are some strategies that sort of work. Just to say, two places where you can find some of this information are online at UNAIDS or at Aid for AIDS, or, to be honest with you, if you're just as simple as typing in AIDS to HIV and the name of your country, you're going to get about 1,000 sites that come up. Don't tax yourself too much. Just give us a basic, you know, couple of stats that show us where HIV and AIDS is at this particular moment. What I'm hoping to find is that I picked these four because they're from various parts of the world, but also because they're dealing with different sort of relationships, which is to say, as you'll see if you haven't read yet, you know, in Haiti we're talking about a long historical connection with the disease because Haiti was the first impoverished nation where this particular illness showed up. So tracing where Haiti is now or where Haiti is in this particular story is to see how the history of AIDS changes over decades, not just in the last decade or two. South Africa has talked a lot about the economics in that place and what are some of the economic situations that are there that make possible the spread of the disease in some way. Zimbabwe has a lot to do to talk about what are some of the cultural sort of implications of that society, how it has impeded or helped with health mechanism. And Thailand has a lot to talk about where it's placed geographically and also its connection to the sex trade industry has provided some interesting connection with HIV and AIDS. So, in other words, when you come back and share, tell us what's in the story, tell us what's in the vignette that's there, and give us an update with a few facts of where those particular things are. Let's have group one meet in here. Group two, across the hall. Not across the hall, but just in the lounge. Group three, want to come to the library? Is that good? And who's group four? Where do you guys want to meet? There's just two of you, so if you care.
That doesn't matter.
Okay, then let's have group four meet.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, don't worry about it.
Probably we can look what the situation from the fact we have from the contact symbols. I feel there are things which were found to contribute to the spread of HIV/AIDS in Thailand. One of it is poverty is another part of, as we have seen, another part of developing countries. Here we have many women who have no other option other than becoming prostitutes in order to earn a living. So it is actually fascinating because we have a young girl who can become a prostitute to be paid a very low wage, up to 40 cents per sexual act. Mm. So we find that many girls can strip up to 3,000 partners per year. So among those prostitutes, we find that almost 60% of them are HIV positive. Another thing which contributed to spread of HIV is culture, belief. While we know that the presence of sores in genitalia is actually like a vector for spread of disease, inside, and especially in men, that is a symbol of manhood. So this might be like a catalyst to make people make a lot of sexual partners in order to get sores,
mm-hmm.
so that they are being regarded as male. But another thing which is a little bit of contrast to other parts of the world, we know that normally in the lesbian communities we have low prevalence, and the gay community have high. But in Thailand it's vice versa. In gay community there is low prevalence, where in the lesbian there is high prevalence. But the fact is that in gay community they educate each other about HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing which actually seems to be another major or contributor of this other risky behavior is drug addict. See, it seems like 40% of teenagers are heroin addict. See,
wow.
In the world, Thailand is the only place where you can get the cheapest and the purest heroin. While you say in US that the heroin contain like 3 to 5% in that snuff, I think, but in Thailand it's 90 to 95% pure. So you find many of them are drug addicts. And among that, 50% of them are HIV positive.
So the purity of the heroin makes one more likely to be addicted, is that what you're saying?
Well, and people from all over go there, it says, to use the heroin.
Yeah,
because
I got it.
It's so pure and cheap.
Right.
So there's a lot of...
Those are two great points. And the point you were making about how cheap the sex acts are is important to make, which is to say poverty is the initial problem that's inspiring a lot of young women and men to having to go into sex work. But it's the fact that it's not just a sex industry, but a cheap sex industry. So they're getting paid very little for the sex acts means they have to do much, many more of them. So ditto for the drug thing. That's interesting.
So I found this, actually I had not gone through, but there are some statistics which show the prevalence of Cali. Like most of them, the latest as you can see is 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Here you find that the prevalence actually, they didn't give the prevalence in general, but it's some subgroups. Like prevalence among brotherly-based sexual workers in 2005, it was 6.8,
mm-hmm.
and prevalence among injecting drug users in 2005, it was 37.6. So you can see it, probably drug addict is more
now
bigger than sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we did a little, as far as the history, they it says around in the 80s, the government kind of ignored it, and they only gave HIV prevention education to the high-risk populations because they kind of thought it was a limited threat.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the 90s, they got a new prime minister who instituted a huge HIV education program, and they instituted a 100% condom program where they gave out condoms for free at brothels, and they required the sex workers and brothel clients to use them, and they could actually shut down brothels if they found that people weren't using
mm-hmm.
them. So that they said that one of the sites I found said without that program, they estimate that HIV prevalence would be 10 times higher than it is currently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why definitely, obviously, the sex workers only have the 6.8% versus 37.6% for injection drug
right.
users. Yeah.
Right. Which is to say that some of the economic problems might still persist, but that there are policy decisions
right.
that were made to sort of
right.
circumnavigate.
Mm-hmm. They kind of ignored it for a while, and then it said they increased the budget like 20 times.
Yeah.
For their prevention programs.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It seems like they keep ramping it up. We found a few more recent stuff where they have kept increasing the program, and now they have a new one. I think it's called like 0% transmission or
mm-hmm.
something, where they want to try to stop it altogether. So.
How would you say then, if you just had to give us a last couple sentence or two, based on the vignette that's provided here in this the book that everybody read, versus what you just sort of looked up and read, what's the narrative for where we were and where we are now in Thailand?
It seems like they took really aggressive steps to try to curtail it. But the remaining, I think, issue is the drug users. The high use of intravenous drugs seems to be the biggest issue.
Yeah. So therefore, I guess you could say that...
Yeah, actually, that's what we are thinking. You know, you give people condom, but we're not sure if they will not use those condoms because they are addicted, especially when they abuse the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to think and make quality decision about condom
yeah.
and be affected by drugs. I think, according to what we have read before, we are looking where we want to go before solving where we are.
Mm-hmm.
We have the problem of drugs.
Yeah.
We have to deal with that. If we can control that, then people can be able to respond.
Yeah, it sounds like the vignette talked about that there was a disparity between, as you said, how effective they were at curtailing HIV transmission among male sex workers versus female sex workers, but it sounds like that started to level off in really significant ways,
right.
But the drug problem persists, which is itself an economic one, you know, that there's a drug industry rendered because of economics that makes it particularly susceptible in Thailand, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the same thing with the sex industry, too, by the way. Thailand is just a natural shipping sort of like loading zone, or so to speak, you know what I mean, a placeholder. So the amount of human traffic that goes through, mm-hmm. both for the drug industry and for the sex industry, is really what exacerbated. And it's curtailing that problem, fueled by the economy that seems mm-hmm. to be at work. All right, let's go to group number two, Haiti.
Okay, so the article mentioned a lot of different possible issues relating to AIDS in Haiti. Specifically, though, it focused on the use of traditional medicine. We found out that, for example, voodoo is practiced among 50% of the population in Haiti, and many people go to traditional healers, but these healers don't provide effective medication. If they do get Western medicine, it's likely to be old, expired, doesn't really work, may even be dangerous. And if they do use them as well, they might go to a doctor who injects them and who doesn't use clean needles to inject different people, so it actually might help transmit AIDS.
And 50% of the current population still is practicing voodoo.
Right, that was today's.
Which is a good stat, which is to say that one way that one can read that narrative is it's not supposed to be Western medicine versus voodoo, you know? Mm-hmm. It seems to be enduring that half the population is interested in voodoo, so it's about wedding or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course people could use both.
Yeah.
Obviously poverty was a huge issue in the 1980s, as it still is today. It said 50% were unemployed and 60% didn't have access to clean drinking water. So if you do have HIV or AIDS, your outcome might be worse off. Let's see. And also in general, we noticed there's like a lack of public health infrastructure, so there's no good surveillance or treating the disease.
Mm-hmm.
The incidence rate was 3,000, but that was done by some doctors, researchers who were coming from the U.S. to look at prevalence rates, and in general the number of cases were outrunning their ability to count them, so they stopped counting.
Mm.
Yeah, their inability to monitor.
Yeah.
Yeah, a testament, I guess, to the infrastructure then also.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of today, so we have numbers from 2009, which were pre-earthquake, but that the prevalence was 1.9% among adults being between 15 to 49.
Mm-hmm.
But we were discussing with after the earthquake, just access to medication, especially with mother-to-baby transmission, the inability to receive formula that doesn't need water, just breastfeeding.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know how the numbers are going to be.
That's fine. And everybody knows we're talking about this, the earthquake date we're talking about, when the earthquake hit Haiti and it was just completely devastating. The earthquake is actually a good, not just analogy, but actually a good example of what the AIDS virus is comparable to, in the sense that clearly AIDS, the pandemic, was devastating in how it affected Haiti, in the same way that the earthquake was devastating. But what made it even more devastating was that when it's a country that's impoverished with poor infrastructure in place, however devastating the earthquake was, or the AIDS crisis was exacerbated by the infrastructural sort of incapacity of that particular place, brought on by poverty, so to speak. So the worry post-earthquake, even if we're just being speculative, is the fact that we can see with precedence what happens when disaster hits a place with poor infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Post-earthquake, one can only imagine that the outlook is pretty bleak. Nevertheless, it's the question of, well, then how infrastructurally do we help them? It's a perfect example, I think, too, then, about like if there are disputes about providing drugs to people with HIV or treatment or education, that doing that without addressing the infrastructural needs would be sort of futile, probably. So, great. Zimbabwe.
There's something about the pictures.
What number? What page are you on? Is there a number?
No, it's for...
What's
for,
it say?
It's for Haiti.
Yeah.
About the pictures.
Bottles?
Yeah, the bottle. Yeah, when they said this is the voodoo drug used to treat people with AIDS. When you look at the labels, these are all labels for liquor.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to use this, reuse these bottles.
Mm-hmm.
So in some way, the voodoo drugs may not have the intended effects because...
Sure, yeah.
This disadvantage also, that
yeah.
they had to...
I think the great take-home point was the one you mentioned about that statistically there's the same percentage of people practicing voodoo still, which is to say that one's job isn't to eradicate it, but one's job is to integrate it, I think. Because what it is just it's a cultural institution, and therefore the implementation of AIDS education and services might not just be through the clinic, but it might be through other services and places too, and that's a great example. All right, Zimbabwe.
Okay, so I guess just to summarize the text here, a lot of healthcare in Zimbabwe comes in the form of traditional medicine that's administered by these spirit mediums. So these spirit mediums kind of like specifically communicate with ancestors and in order to like diagnose like conditions and like suggest like treatments for those conditions. It's a lot of like herbal and like spiritual treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a practice that they do where they will cut like a vein in your arm and kind of like administer herbs through that, like herbal treatments through that wound. So that's, a very easy way for the virus to spread. What else?
And one of their culture is that if one person is sick, they have to treat the whole family. So if they cut one person, it means they cut all the other members of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So it easily spread the infection.
Mm-hmm.
And so 95% of the people do go to traditional healers.
Yeah.
It's only a few, 5% who believe in or trust Western medicine. And that was the problem. And another issue here is as years goes, by 2005, the Ministry of Health decided to do the education. So they kind of start teaching from 11 years.
Mm.
So 11 years would be taught about the HIV and the transmission and everything. So by 2005, with behavioral change, use of condom and few sexual partners, delay in sexual intercourse, the transmission kind of went down.
Mm-hmm.
But then here comes the economic crisis,
mm-hmm.
and they say there is brain drain doctors who are overworked and poorly paid, so the treatment of HIV also goes down, and people are kind of trying to look for medication
mm-hmm.
in neighboring countries.
You said because they're overworked and underpaid?
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
the doctors are running from the country, maybe.
Yeah.
And also, Zimbabwe economically currently is really in bad shape, and the price of everything is very high. The people cannot afford buying the drugs, even their own food, so there is a high rate of mortality due to malnutrition, lack of drugs, and all those.
That's a great take-home point, too, that quite often we're talking about the drugs being too expensive for a particular country or economy. It's not because everything's affordable and drugs are expensive. It's because across the board, there is an expensive sort of standard of life there. It's interesting, too, the anecdote you mentioned, too, about the fact that when one person is sick, then some places there's a tendency to want to treat the whole family with this particular cutting procedure. Because what that speaks to is a cultural understanding of what disease communicability looks like. You know what I mean? So one person in the family has it. Maybe we should treat the whole family in some way. In some ways, it goes cross purposes with how we understand how HIV is actually transmitted. So one needs to realize that there's one understanding of disease culturally versus another that we know epidemiologically and how to compromise those two different worldviews. Maybe not to disabuse the other, you know, worldview, but how to find a way with which to, just, again, try to integrate the two together. Otherwise, what ends up happening is the fact that you're telling people a strategy that doesn't jive with what their worldview and cosmology and reality is. So, and that's the tricky part. It's a hard part to do. It's much easier to just go in and say, this is what we do with HIV, and this is the way you can stop prevent it. But unless it has a way that speaks to changing and differing sort of cultural understandings of disease and health, then it will probably fall on deaf ears. So it tends to be the case. Any other thoughts on Zimbabwe?
Yeah. I think it was also important that the healers, I think at first, it didn't go into a lot of detail, but it said at first easy transmission happened through this sort of cutting technique, but that the healers came together and educated themselves so that they could go back to the patients and talk about how HIV is transmitted. So it sounds like they, I wish there was more, they had said more about it, but it sounds like they sort of had gotten a handle on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, you know, a prevalent form of.
I wonder if it had to do with the fact that it was done collectively. You know, you said that people come together. I wonder if it happened because it was motivated from both sides. I wonder if it just didn't happen also because it brought local understandings of medical treatment and healing to the table about what was happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It could have been all any of those things. But
yeah, but I think in here, in one of the pictures here, there is a midwife and the traditional healer discussing maybe something. And I think maybe kind of midwives maybe were discussing like the way of transmitting the disease, so these traditional healers get like to know what's going on.
Yeah. Oh, and that's actually an interesting anecdote to mention because in most Western countries, the most prevalent form of sort of alternative sort of thing is the midwife. I mean, it's still a very respected sort of like profession that is of a different sort of like vein, so to speak. So it might be that midwives are actually a perfect sort of like avenue or vehicle with which to implement the beginnings of that very sort of like wedding. Okay, last one, South Africa.
All right, so the short article was, the time point was the late 80s and 1990. The two major issues, I guess, that contributed to the AIDS epidemic was social and the political structure of the country. So I guess the political structure would be the apartheid system, where it's was racial segregation, and the article goes into about the social aspect of it, where men left their families behind to work in these hostels, and they can they sign like two year contracts, and the hostel conditions were similar to like prisons, to where they couldn't leave unless they were halfway. In their contract, and then they could only leave for like 4 weeks and to go see their family. And then it also says that there were it wasn't uncommon for homosexual relationships to develop. And then they I guess would go back to their wives, and then it would disseminate that way.
Mm-hmm.
But then it goes into to the women's. I guess the men left the women's behind, and they often had their own secondary partners and secondary relationships too. So if the article didn't contributed that it was primarily affecting heterosexuals, so it wasn't like homosexuals weren't like it wasn't like stigma around that that class or whatever. And that's about it. So it talks about the healthcare in South Africa was racially segregated. And due to the apartheid system.
Right.
And that's basically where it kind of ended.
Apartheid, what year, 89? What year did apartheid end?
91.
Okay.
94.
Which is to, 94, okay. Which is to place it sort of squarely in a moment when AIDS is fully entrenched in sub-Saharan Africa and yet poised to potentially have some healthcare improvements, but a political crisis or a change, which you could say that, you know, it's a game changer. Yeah.
Along with the, I'll give you a now scenario, which is hugely different. In the article that we have, it says that no government programs for people with people with HIV, AIDS, and there will likely never be one. And now there's been a complete turnaround. As a matter of fact, if anybody wants to look at healthcare reform, what's happening in South Africa is a really good example, because not only did they have more people with HIV than anywhere in the world, but there was an estimated 5.6 million people were living with AIDS in South Africa in 2009, the highest number of people in any country. They also had an 80% positive for TB. So HIV AIDS wasn't the only huge healthcare crisis. It was also they had a myriad of different problems. And so what's happening now is that the government has gotten involved, and they have the biggest implementation of the largest HIV counseling and testing campaign in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's Jimmy Earl Perry, big movie star for Cats. He's become the UN ambassador to South Africa for HIV/AIDS. But what they did was that they abolished the silos, and they've taken a family-centered approach. It avoids fragmentation that results in multiple community health workers visiting families. It focuses on health promotion and prevention, rehabilitative and referral services, rather than exclusively on curative services.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a multi-pronged approach to some formidable diseases, and they're having good response. Mm-hmm. So that's the very good news with South Africa.
It'd be interesting, which is to say that there's been such political, economic, and epidemiological sort of like upheaval, really, in the last 15, 20 years, so to speak, in South Africa. What that's also translated to, though, is the ability to sort of do big things fast right away, which is to say, the results don't seem to be in yet in terms of the AIDS incidence decreasing in South Africa, but hopefully it will, which is to say, and we see this advancement in other places, which is to say, South Africa is actually, in the entire world, has some of the most progressive laws on human rights, on gay rights, on things like that, which is to say, it's breaking down, surprisingly, apartheid, which was one of the most sort of outdated, worst sort of human rights sort of scenarios, made possible for sweeping sort of changes. Now, having said that, the platform for what is the economic and epidemiological situation in South Africa is still sad, but there is a whole embrace of this proactive policy development that's trying to make major changes. Yeah.
Huge. They just have like knocked down a lot of the existing, which was being knocked down anyway, and out of that came a lot of creativity through different approaches. But I would just like to also mention that they have a 53% reduction in the price of antiviral medicines. Now, South Africa isn't just somebody who would go and rob, intellectual. I just want to put that forth, that these are the people that took the patents, and they were sued by everybody, and they really had huge pressing problems, and they're not like the big backward country that this intellectually backwater country is robbing academia.
I understand what you're saying. Which is to say that when thinking of the whatever the escape plan is, or whatever the the idea of having to break a patent and do something else in certain times and certain moments, it's the right justifiable thing to do. It's on its own grounds in its own moment.
As you said, like sometimes the principal method, when they were just faced with a huge, huge problem.
Yeah, one of the interesting things to take home about South Africa too is that we're talking about a country here that for the better part of 20, 30, 50 years was sort of set, was internationally sanctioned. There was a moratorium on relations, trade, services, or what have you, and South Africa has been a very good model, and since post-apartheid, about taking advantage of international assistance and connections, perhaps because of decades of not even able to have the right to have it. So anyway, I just wanted to end on those vignettes, and I want to pass one last thing out for everybody to take a look at. It's going to sort of give us a setup for what we're talking about next week. Next week we're talking about, Nick was our last class, and we're talking about disability protection attached to HIV, which is to say, as we move towards the kind of chronicity of AIDS, or the possibility for chronicity of AIDS, we tended to refer to AIDS now in the category of disability. So I want us to think about the benefits, the perils, the pitfalls. Here you go. So this is an article that came out in 2010 for basically what Obama initiated in the first, if you can see, 4th of January 2010, in sort of the middle of his first term. And it's about how the U.S. lifted in 2000 its immigration ban on HIV and AIDS. This is another international-related policy, but actually it speaks to the topic for next week, which is to say, we talked largely about testing, treatment, funding for HIV internationally, but one of the big things that speaks to international AIDS and HIV is mobility itself, the ability for people to travel, to have residency, to become citizens in countries, and how HIV and AIDS is sometimes used to bar that. Those policies were instituted in the 80s to curtail the disease, but also to try to make sure that our country does not become one of those countries with the devastating statistics. So keeping people from becoming citizens simply because they had HIV wasn't just an epidemiological move, it was a statistical move. And so the move now is to try to repeal that. This article comes out stating, that at the time in 2010 when AIDS, when people with HIV and AIDS were not allowed to come to the United States, there were only 12 countries that still had that policy, and the number is even less now. I think it's maybe closer to 10 or half that. So, but I want you to take a look at that, get you ready for next week, and have a good week, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.